I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. A year ago, Donald Trump's presidential campaign was in trouble. The conventions were over. His poll numbers were falling. He had conflicts with key members of his Republican Party, and he got into fights with Gold Star parents, firefighters, even a crying baby. On August 17th, he hired Steve Bannon to be his campaign CEO, booting out Paul Manafort. Bannon had no political experience, but he understood the anger and the yearnings of the alt-right and the politically disaffected from his time as executive chair of Breitbart News. He'd also tapped into the mindset of young gamers, young men who were gamers, I should say, when he was vice chairman of Internet Gaming Entertainment. Our guest Joshua Green writes in his new book, Devil's Bargain, that Bannon used those experiences to help Trump over the finish line in November, much to the surprise and shock of the establishment and Hillary Clinton. Bannon is now White House chief strategist, one of the more enigmatic figures in Trump's inner circle. And unlike Priebus, Flynn, and Scaramucci, he is still there. We asked Joshua Green to join us on Radio Times to discuss Bannon's multiple lives, his attraction to a dark worldview, and his influence on the president. He's senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Joshua Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Would we have President Trump if he hadn't been told to hire Steve Bannon?
I submit in the book that we would not, and there are two reasons for that, and the two threads in my book, I think, explain them. The first is that Bannon was really the guy who came up with this idea of populist nationalism. Trump had always had these impulses. If you go back and look at some of his early feints at running for president as far back as 1988, he said some very populist things, but he didn't really have a developed politics, and Steve Bannon did, and I think that was important to Trump's victory. The other side of the piece, and this is the story that most people, I think, don't know, is that before he came to Trump, Bannon had spent years building up these series of conservative organizations that were all geared toward tearing down Hillary Clinton, who Bannon and a lot of other people assumed was going to be the Democratic nominee. So the book basically weaves together the backstory of how the campaign happened and how Bannon and Trump came together and were able to pull probably the greatest presidential upset of my lifetime.
Well, we know Karl Rove as Bush's brain. People talk about a puppet master. How do you see that relationship between both candidate and now President Trump and Steve Bannon?
So I actually don't see Bannon as being a puppet master or even necessarily a Rove figure. Although, as you point out, in political journalism, we're accustomed to thinking along these certain kinds of tropes. I think what Bannon is slightly different. Trump, as we can all now see, is not really controllable by anybody, not by Steve Bannon, not by his staff, not by General Kelly, judging from his Twitter feed. I think what Bannon is instead was a kind of pit bull or soldier for Trump who shared his politics and who had his respect in a way that a lot of Trump staffers didn't. The classic Trump staffer is a kind of, you know, obsequious lackey. Some of Trump's senior guys, you know, started out as caddies for him and things like that. These aren't people who have grown up and have independent professional accomplishments. Bannon, however, has this wild backstory and had made himself rich as a Hollywood deal maker, as a Wall Street guy before he ever met Trump. So I think Trump had a certain degree of respect for him that he didn't for other people. But Bannon's role really in the campaign and even now into the administration was saving Trump anytime he got in trouble, whether it was the Fox News attacks early in the Republican primary or the Access Hollywood tape or now the expanding Russia probe that threatens Trump's presidency. Bannon is always the guy that Trump turns to in a pinch.
You write that Bannon was looking for a vessel for his ideas. He for a time been interested in Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann. But what did he recognize in Donald Trump that others didn't see, including Roger Ailes, who basically dismissed a Trump both candidacy and presidency? What did Steve Bannon see that others did not?
Well, it's funny. I tell the story in the book of how I first met Bannon, and it was back in 2011, and I'd just come back from Alaska, where I'm a political reporter. I'd done a big profile of Sarah Palin, who we all thought was going to run for president in 2012. And the piece had a bit of a contrarian take. It wasn't all negative about Palin, which a lot of articles back then were. And I got a phone call from a film publicist saying, hey, I represent this filmmaker. He really loved your article. Would you come to the sound studio in Arlington, Virginia, and meet him and see his film about Sarah Palin? I thought, sure.
Who's this guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I show up, and the guy is Steve Bannon, looking and sounding exactly like he does today, you know, kind of unkempt military field jacket. You couldn't tell if he was crazy or serious, but clearly a smart guy. And I didn't think a lot of his Palin film, but he had a very distinct, interesting kind of populist politics that you didn't see a lot of in Washington at that time. And so as a magazine writer, I'm attracted to people like this because they're more interesting than your run-of-the-mill Republicans and Democrats. And so I got to know Bannon over the next couple years, eventually wrote about him. What I didn't know then was that he had just met Donald Trump and had begun tutoring him on politics. They met through a veteran Republican consultant named David Bossie, who is famous in Washington for having been an anti-Clinton activist for years and years, and the guy behind the Supreme Court's decision, Citizens United decision, back in 2010 that really opened up the floodgates to money in politics. But what Bannon saw in Trump, I think initially, was just a guy it would be fun to hang out with. Bannon didn't take Trump's presidential ambition seriously when he first met him in 2010, 2011. Bossie would bring him up to tutor Trump. And I think Bannon thought of it as a lark because, like everybody else, he thought of Trump as being this, you know, celebrity apprentice guy, but not someone who would ever seriously run for president, much less win. I think that didn't change until about 2014, 2015, when it became clear that Trump was really connecting with a lot of grassroots Republican voters. And at that point, Bannon became more serious about guiding and shaping Trump's politics.
I do want to talk more about Trump and Bannon's relationship, but you described Bannon as unkempt. Others have described him as a slob. I mean, clearly he has this disheveled appearance. What are we to make of that? Is it a studied kind of thing, or he just doesn't care?
It is very much a studied kind of thing, although why anybody would want to study and wind up looking like that, I couldn't tell you. Bannon had spent most of his life in wearing one uniform or another. He went to a right-wing Catholic military high school, as did Donald Trump, also went to a military high school. He was in the Navy. He was at Goldman Sachs. So if you see pictures of him from earlier on in life, you know, he looks perfectly well-dressed and even handsome. And once he made all his money, I think it was his way of giving a kind of sartorial middle finger to the rest of the world that, you know, I have made it. I am independent now, and I'm going to dress in my flip-flops and cargo shorts.
And he'll wear
like four or five shirts at a time. It's the oddest style I've ever seen. He'll wear, you know, Oxford shirts on top of polo shirts. It's as though he's frigid or something. I've never really understood what it was. But this is very much a cultivated look. And one of the funny things about Bannon being in Trump's orbit initially was Trump, as Sean Spicer can tell you, is a stickler for appearance, and everybody around him tends to wear a suit and tie and be very well dressed. So it was funny to see Bannon early on in the Trump orbit because he's this one disheveled guy following around in the inner entourage who just didn't look like he fit. But I think that connection he had with Trump was genuine, or Trump wouldn't have kept a person like that around.
He grew up in Virginia, a part of a conservative but blue-collar family that tended to vote Democrat. That sounds a lot like Trump supporters today. And was educated in a certain kind of Catholicism. I'll be honest with you, I'd never heard of Tridentine. What is that kind of Catholicism about?
Well, Tridentine Catholicism is just a very traditional form of Catholicism that involves the Latin Mass and that sort of thing. It was done away with after the Vatican II reforms in the mid-1960s, but in the mid-1980s, Pope John Paul brought it back. And so for people who want to practice a deeply traditional brand of Catholicism, they can become Tridentine Catholics or attend Tridentine Mass, which Bannon's family did. One of the things I tried to do in this book was trace the roots of Bannon's very unusual political and geopolitical views, right. And also his nationalist politics. And the thread traced back to his Catholic upbringing, and in particular, a very conservative right-wing form of Western civ that he was taught in his military high school. I interviewed a couple of his classmates, and one of them told me, you know, we were taught as early as our freshman year that Christendom was always under assault, you know, historically from the forces of Islam and other places, whether it was Ferdinand and Isabella, the Catholic monarchs in Spain in the 1500s, repelling an invasion from the Moors. You know, Steve Bannon was taught from an early age that you have to be, you know, alert and ready and willing to defend the Western world. And so Bannon has a very grandiose sense of himself, which I think comes through in a lot of what he writes for Trump. And I trace this back to his upbringing. I mean, he really does have this apocalyptic worldview that says, you know, the Western world is always in danger of being, you know, overrun and collapsing.
Well, you also say that he has been a follower of this French metaphysician, René Guénon. He was a Roman Catholic. He practiced Freemasonry, later became a Sufi Muslim and observed Sharia. So put that together for us, this Catholicism and then this René Guénon. How does that fit together?
Because it doesn't fit to my mind. This gets very weird very quickly. So one of the things that I asked Bannon in the course of reporting for the book was, at various points over the past couple of years, there have been videos and interviews of Bannon that could come out, including one famous one at a Vatican conference in 2014, where he has name-checked certain rather obscure philosophers from the 1930s and 40s, such as a guy named Julius Evola, who was Benito Mussolini's chief racial theorist, later made common cause with the Nazis. You know, I asked Ben, I said, well, how is it if you claim not to be an anti-Semite and a white nationalist, as many people charge that he is, how is it that you're familiar with these people? And he said, oh, well, you know, I'm a nationalist, and I spent a lot of years kind of reading up and trying to build an intellectual underpinning, and Evola and a lot of his cohorts in the 1930s were really the strongest nationalists, and while I don't agree with their views on race and a lot of the things that they did, you know, I read all their works, and that led me back to a guy named René Guénon, who I had never heard of, who is a sort of godfather of a movement called primordial traditionalism. And this is Bannon's big thing. And yes, it is very ironic that Steve Bannon's guru is a Muslim who practiced the Sharia. But Guénon is a fascinating figure. He's born in late 19th century France, raised a Roman Catholic like Bannon was. But became interested in occultism and Freemasonry, eventually converted to Sufi Islam. But he developed this idea that there is a transcendent unity at the heart of all ancient religions, whether it's paganism or the Hindu Vedanta or Sufi Islam. And Guénon's contention was that this connection, man's connection to the transcendent, to God, began to be lost with the rise of the Enlightenment in the 1500s. So what Guénon wanted was a return to traditional civilization. That's also what Bannon wants. And so that informs a lot of his thinking about why we need to destroy the administrative state in the EU and all these secular, liberal, bureaucratic organizations.
And Joshua, hold on to that thought only because we're up on a break.
And I'll follow up after the break.
We have a clip queued up as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm Marty Moscoane, and I'm talking with Joshua Green. He's at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, author of this new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joshua, let me play a clip. And this is Steve Bannon speaking at via Skype. And he's at a conference or speaking to a conference that's held at the Vatican. And this is 2014.
I believe the world, and particularly the Judeo-Christian West, is in a crisis. And it's really the organizing principle of how we built Breitbart News to really be a platform to bring news and information to people throughout the world, principally in the West, but we're expanding internationally, to let people understand the depths of this crisis. And it is a crisis both of capitalism but really of the underpinnings of the Judeo-Christian West in our beliefs.
Joshua, what's at the root of this crisis as Steve Bannon sees it?
Well, this is what we just talked about. This is pure Gagnonian traditionalism. And Bannon went on in that interview to talk about a dark age. And this stems from an idea that Bannon has talked about a lot and seems to really be captivated with. It's based on the Hindu concept of cyclical time. And Gagnon, his Muslim guru, believed that the world was passing through a 6,000-year-long dark age, and that in which tradition would be wholly forgotten. So you hear Bannon there talking about a crisis of the West, a crisis of Judeo-Christian faith. What he's worried about is that the rise of the modern nation state is severing our connection to God. And so Gagnon believed, as Bannon believed, that you have to fight back against that by reasserting your national identity and trying to do away with these soulless bureaucratic groups that erase national borders essentially erase the kind of America first nationalism that Bannon stands for. So it's a very odd lineage for a political philosophy. It's almost like something from the Da Vinci Code or a Dan Brown novel. And I asked Bannon at one point, I said, do you really believe this?
I was going to ask you whether he really believes this.
And he said, oh, yes, I do. So when people talk about, people used to talk about in the campaign, well, Donald Trump and Steve Bannon want to take America back to an earlier time. What they usually meant was that they wanted to take America back to the 1940s or the 1950s, some pre-civil rights era time. What Bannon really wants to do is take America back to something more along the lines of the 1500s, where you really did have a strong Christian presence in government and everywhere else. And that's sort of an odd philosophy for someone in Bannon's position to have. I guarantee you that Karl Rove doesn't believe that.
Is he an Islamophobe?
It's a tricky question. He is certainly outspokenly hostile to radical Islamic jihad. But as we've just covered, his own personal guru embraced Islam and practiced the Sharia. So I'm not quite sure how to answer it. He is very worried about the fact that Islam is encroaching on the West. That's how Bannon sees it, or invading or attacking the West. And one of the biographical stories I tell in the book is that Bannon in the Navy was actually in the Persian Gulf during the Iranian hostage, the failed rescue mission to rescue American hostages from Iran in 1980, and saw that go badly, which is what originally turned Bannon from a Democrat to a Republican. Then, you flash forward 20 years, the September 11th attacks on Wall Street, where Bannon had worked. I think that he has become, or that he became radicalized against Islam and believed that it really was a threat to Western civilization, as we heard him say in that Vatican conference. And that echoes a lot of what Donald Trump, I think, said on the campaign trail. If you just listen to his inaugural address, the idea of American carnage and the dark image of the West in decline, that's all Steve Bannon.
Let me play another clip, and this is Steve Bannon. He's now, this is 2015, November 2015. He's talking to Republican Congressman Ryan Zinke of Montana, who happens to be the Secretary of the Interior. And this, of course, is Steve Bannon before he began working for Donald Trump. Let's give it a listen.
Well, I think we need to do two things, or three things. One is we need to put a stop on refugees until we can vet. We've been through a number of classified briefings.
Why stop until we vet? I don't understand. What do you mean vet? Well, why not just stop? Why are you going through all this thing on vetting? The opportunity cost of vetting.
Vetting's important because we don't know
why. No, you only vet stop, Commander. You only vet if you're going to let him in. Why even let him in?
And of course, that last voice is Steve Bannon, opposed to them, Muslims or people from Muslim countries coming into the U.S.
And I think it's even broader than that. We saw this week that Donald Trump endorsed a Senate bill that would lower even legal immigration to the United States, and not just from Muslim-majority countries, all immigration. I mean, I think this is Bannon's way of trying to assert an American identity to push back The idea that immigrants have a place in the United States, that they're welcome here, this is part and parcel of Bannon's worldview. And I think it's why when Trump was elected, one of the very first things that Trump did was to sign the executive order banning refugees and migrants from these seven Muslim-majority countries. I think what Bannon is trying to do, and Trump seems inclined to go along with this, is to just change the nature of America's relationship with the rest of the world. Instead of, you know, embracing immigrants and refugees from abroad, as America traditionally has, he wants to shut down the borders and focus all government resources on American citizens who are already here. And that's a sharp break, not just from Barack Obama and the Democrats, but from what most Republicans want to do as well.
That's Joshua Green, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. We're talking about his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. See comments coming in, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can tweet us at whyy Radio Times. I began with my introduction of a year ago, the Donald Trump presidential campaign was in dire straits, in many ways in deep trouble. And it was Rebecca Mercer of the very wealthy Mercer family who told Trump that he should really hire Bannon. Why did she play in between, and what did she see in Bannon that she thought Trump needed?
Well, I do a chapter in the book on the Mercer family and their influence and importance in Republican politics and in the rise of Trump and Bannon. And for those who aren't familiar with him, the patriarch of the family is a brilliant mathematician named Bob Mercer, who is, I believe, the co-CEO of Renaissance Technologies, a very secretive hedge fund in Long Island that is one of the most profitable. It may be the most profitable hedge fund in the world. But Mercer has very hard right conservative views, and beginning a number of years ago, began to invest a lot of money in Republican politics. Initially, in some fairly mainstream organizations, he wasn't all that different than the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. But then, really in frustration, I think, with an inability of Republicans to get results, he broke off and started supporting his own candidates and his own causes. And Mercer was the money behind a lot of Bannon's organizations. He invested money in Breitbart News. He invested money in a think tank down in Florida, which produced the book Clinton Cash, which was so damaging to Clinton. It came out on the eve of her presidential announcement, and also runs a data analytics firm that was very important in the Trump presidential campaign. But the real political actor in that family is his daughter, Rebecca Mercer. And she not only set up super PACs for Donald Trump and donated to him directly, but was a very active member of Trump's inner circle. And when, in August, after the Republican National Convention, when Trump really seemed to be flailing, he was attacking Fox News one day and attacking the Khan family the next. He was down about 8 or 10 points in the polls. Mercer, I have a scene in the book where Mercer flies to Long Island to a fundraiser and essentially tells Trump, you're going to lose if you don't make a change, but I have just the team to put in place. And it wasn't just Bannon. It was also important. It was the campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, and later David Bossie, the guy who had first introduced Trump to Bannon way back in 2010. And all of these people, Bannon, Bossie, and Conway, had been in the Mercer's employ for a number of years and, in fact, had been running some of these groups and super PACs that were focused on tearing down Clinton long before Donald Trump was even the Democratic or Republican nominee. So it made a certain kind of sense for Mercer to say, look, you're running against Hillary Clinton. You need some very aggressive people that know how to attack Clinton. Well, I happen to have three of them right here, and Trump agreed and put them in charge of his campaign.
If we're talking about the inner circle, is it more a team of people who hate Hillary Clinton and wanted to take her down, or was it that they saw something in Donald Trump that would make the kind of president they were looking for?
Well, I do think that they all hated Hillary Clinton and wanted to tear her down. Some of them, like Bossie and Conway, had been attacking the Clinton family going all the way back to the mid to late 1990s during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Conway first rose to fame as a conservative pundit during the Monica scandal, and Bossie was a congressional investigator in the House Government Oversight Committee that was investigating a lot of the supposed Clinton scandals in the 90s. Bannon, never a fan of Hillary Clinton. I think Bannon, though, really did become a true believer in Trump because Trump's impulses, his populist impulses, really meshed with what Bannon wanted to do in the world. And I think Bannon also came to appreciate what a talented politician Donald Trump was. Even though he had no experience, he could get up on stage and absolutely dominate these other Republican candidates, these governors and senators, you know, Bush family members who were supposed to be the best of the best. And so while a lot of people in Bannon's orbit, including the Mercers, Kellyanne Conway and David Bossie, all initially went to Ted Cruz and were involved in a super PAC that supported Cruz. As soon as Cruz lost and Trump was clearly going to be the nominee, they all swung behind Donald Trump and were very important in his win.
Let me play something that Hillary Clinton said. This was August 25th, 2016. I feel like I'm having flashbacks. I know, I'm talking about what happened last summer. But this is Hillary Clinton responding to the fact that Donald Trump had hired Steve Bannon.
And the latest shakeup was designed to, quote, let Trump be Trump. So to do that, he hired Stephen Bannon, the head of a right-wing website called Breitbart.com, as the campaign CEO. Now, to give you a flavor of his work, here are a few headlines they've published. And I'm not making this up. Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer? Gabby Giffords, the gun control movement's human shield. Hoisted high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage.
And that's a scene from the campaign trail, August 25th, 2016, in Reno, Nevada. To you, Joshua Green, what did Hillary Clinton not understand about Donald Trump and his supporters?
Well, that's a great question. I think what she didn't understand was this speech, which was famous during the campaign because Clinton was really the person who introduced the term alt-right to the popular culture.
Yes.
That was what she was doing in that speech, was trying to smear Trump by association with Bannon and Breitbart News and all these social media forces that seem to kind of arise from the swamp and attack critics of Trump and attack reporters. I think what she didn't understand was that that didn't have quite the negative effect on Trump's standing that she thought it would. And the idea behind that speech essentially was to educate voters who might be on the fence between the two candidates and say, listen, you know, Donald Trump may be a path breaker and you may like the fact that he's railing against the establishment, but he has these terrible associations with anti-Semites and racists. And let me just show you this by connecting with Steve Bannon. That didn't really end up working in the way that Clinton's people hoped it did, which is something I talked to both campaigns about this in the book. And Bannon at the time, this is back during the campaign, was polling this stuff and told me that speech didn't matter. You know, people who think we're racist aren't going to vote for us, but she's already got their vote. That speech isn't moving over any new voters. And so during the final months of the campaign, there was really a tug of war for a group of independent voters that the Trump camp dubbed double haters. There were people who hated Trump and who hated Clinton, but historical evidence showed that they usually showed up at the polls to vote. And so the question was, who would they vote for? Clinton, in that speech, was hoping to effectively disqualify Donald Trump in the eyes of those voters, and it didn't work. In the end, what ended up happening was Trump, with help from James Comey's letter, the FBI director reopening Clinton's investigation about 10 days before the election, was able to win over a lot of those double haters. And in both campaigns, the people I talked to thought that that was really the deciding factor in the race.
In fact, that seemed like Steve Bannon and other members of Trump's inner circle seemed to understand that this really put a knife in her campaign.
I think it did. I mean, if you look at what Bannon brought to Trump's campaign when he came in mid-August, it was essentially a set of arguments against Hillary Clinton that Bannon and the people around him had spent years honing and developing and researching. And the thrust of that critique was that Clinton was thoroughly corrupt, that she was getting, she and her foundation were getting secret payments from foreign autocrats, that she was giving speeches to Wall Street banks that were secret and Clinton wouldn't release the transcripts, that she'd had her own private email server. And the basic idea was that she was corrupt in a way that was simply irredeemable. And the only way to kind of take back America and take back the country was to vote for Donald Trump. That is the reason why I think the race was a lot closer in October and in early November than anybody expected. But it was really Comey's letter coming out and saying, okay, we are reopening this investigation into Hillary Clinton's email. The fact that the FBI is opening an investigation of Clinton 10 days or whatever it was before the election seemed to reconfirm all of the charges that Trump and Bannon were making, and it pushed enough people over into Trump's camp that he was able to eke out a win.
We have about 60 seconds before our second break here. An email from Tommy. How did Bannon and Roger Stone get along? Did you look at that?
Yes, I did.
How could you not? You know, right?
Like many people in Trump's orbit, they are hot and cold. They're both outsiders. They're both very smart, clever men with a fascination for the dark arts. I think right now they're not getting along very well because Roger Stone has been tweeting all sorts of negative stuff about my book.
Wow.
A lot of this is jockeying for the king's attention. And, you know, right now Bannon is the White House and Stone is the one on the outside. But if you go back 5 years, Stone was probably Trump's most important advisor. So I think the answer to that is that it changes from day to day.
And apparently the president does not like your book.
That's what some
word
news
on the
reports
street,
have
I guess.
Said. Yes, that he's unhappy with the idea that anybody but Donald Trump was responsible for Donald Trump's victory. He and I will have to disagree on that, but I'd be interested if he'd actually read the book or just glanced at the cover.
Well, Joshua, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Joshua Green, our guest, his book is titled The Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency, in part talking about last year's presidential campaign, but obviously much to talk about facing the White House. House and the country. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Email radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscowane talking with Joshua Green about Steve Bannon, his various lives, his unusual career, the development of his political ideas, and his relationship with Trump, both on the campaign trail and in the White House. Let me play a clip, and this is Steve Bannon speaking at CPAC in February. Obviously, the Trump administration is in gear. And he is talking about the cabinet. Let's give it a listen.
I think if you look at the lines of work, I kind of break it out into three verticals or three buckets. The first is kind of national security and sovereignty, and that's your intelligence, the Defense Right. Department, Homeland Security. The second line of work is what I refer to as economic nationalism, and that is Wilbur Ross at Commerce, Steve Mnuchin at Treasury, Lighthizer at Trade, Peter Navarro, Stephen Miller, these people that are rethinking how we're going to reconstruct the our trade arrangements around the world. The third, broadly, line of work is what is deconstruction of the administrative state. And if you... So I think the three most important things, I think one of the most pivotal moments in modern American history was his immediate withdrawal from TPP.
And again, Steve Bannon speaking at CPAC in February. The deconstruction of the administrative state, Joshua Green, gets a big applause line.
Well, it does. And I think it means two things. Number one, the deconstruction of the administrative state, if you're just a traditional small government conservative, means that Bannon and Trump are going to work to unwind regulations and get government regulators off the backs of, you know, bankers and so on and so forth. On a deeper level, though, since we've been talking about Bannon's traditionalism, what it means, and you heard him talk about TPP and yeah. some of these international organizations, is it scales back global government. It scales back these multilateral, multi-nation organizations that Bannon thinks are taking over the world and severing our connection to God. So one of the things that Bannon wants to do is blow up the European Union and TPP and all these organizations that have been built up because he wants to return to a small government pre-Enlightenment state where organizations like that don't interfere with the business that he and the people around him want to be focused on.
I mean, it's such a strange juxtaposition between God and TPP. You know, what would Jesus
really
say
is,
about TPP?
But here's what you learn being around Steve Bannon. He is just full of strange juxtapositions. I mean, the thread that he traces through, the best analogy I can come up with is a Dan Brown novel. I mean, he'll start talking about TPP, and all of a sudden you're back in, you know, 14th century France and the Knights of the Templar. Wow. And it is one of the fun research strands in the book is sort of trying to connect all of Bannon's beliefs and influences and show how they've affected Trump. And while that's interesting from a research perspective, it's kind of scary from a political perspective because he is now in a position where he's able to do that. And on TPP and in trying to undermine a lot of these international organizations, it's worth remembering that the very first foreign leader that Trump met with after he was elected was Nigel Farage, who, of course, was the great champion of Brexit in the UK, which was designed to undermine the European Union. So you can see how Bannon and Trump are putting some of these ideas into practice from the White House.
Let me read something that Elizabeth Williamson wrote in the New York Times recently. This is talking about Bannon. He seemed at times a voice for sanity, although in the Trump White House, that's a relative term. He objected to Mr. Trump's untimely firing of James Comey. He warned Mr. Trump against continuing his abusive campaign against Mr. Sessions. He opposed Mr. Scaramucci's appointment, saying Mr. Trump needed a professional, not another inexperienced loyalist, to guide a press shop whose messaging consists mostly of post-tweet babble. On policy matters, Mr. Bannon opposes further troop commitments to Afghanistan. He has urged that taxes on the incomes of the wealthiest Americans remain high as part of any comprehensive tax reform. He understands the base more than anybody else. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think people tend to focus on the darker or crazier ideas that Bannon is pushing. But it's worth remembering that he is in a White House full of amateurs, and that includes the president. And a lot of them have some very bad ideas about how Trump should behave. And case number one, I think, as Williamson pointed out, was the idea that it was a good idea to fire FBI Director James Comey. Now, Bannon had been against that, but other people in the administration were for it. So as odd as it sounds, given all we've learned about Bannon on the show today, yeah, that he could be the voice of stability and reason in the White House, I think in a lot of cases that's actually true.
A tweet from Nelly says, it seems like people and news keep leaving Bannon out of the conversation when he really is a threat to American democracy. Is he a threat to our democracy?
Well, I'm not sure quite how to answer the question. I mean, if it's on an issue like Comey, no, I don't think he is. I think he is trying to, you know, what Bannon really wants is a functioning White House to carry out his nationalist beliefs. I think the threat comes from Trump's impulses to destroy a constitutional system, which, you know, were he to find a way to fire special counsel Bob Mueller, who's investigating him on Russia, might really be a threat to our democracy. So I don't think that Bannon is by any means, a traditional or necessarily a healthy political influence, but I think that Trump, more than Bannon, is the real threat. And one of the things that you hear talking privately to a lot of Trump advisors is that they kind of recognize this, too, that Trump isn't really controllable. And you might be able to get him settled down for a couple days, but eventually Trump is going to do what he wants to do. And nobody, not General Kelly, not Steve Bannon, not Reince Priebus, not Ivanka Trump, is going to be able to stop him from doing that. And if you look at the thrust of Trump's complaints over the past few weeks and months, they've really been geared toward this Russia investigation. And so I think there's a lot of worry in the White House that Trump is going to arrive at a point where he decides no more. I am the president. I have the power. I'm going to find a way to get Mueller out of here. And if that happens, then I think we really do have a constitutional crisis.
Well, indeed. Where does Bannon stand on that? And has he lawyered up? Is there anything that ties him to this Russia investigation?
So far as we know, there's not. And Bannon, at least as of a couple weeks ago, had not hired a lawyer and has not been implicated, so far as I'm aware, in any of the Russia stuff. I think there are two reasons for this. One is that despite the crazy man image, Bannon is a pretty sophisticated guy. You know, he's a major deal maker at Goldman Sachs and a big, you know, muckety muck in Hollywood. He isn't a naive rube in a way that like Don Trump Jr. is. So I think he might be smart enough to avoid some of that stuff. But the real reason is he didn't join the campaign until August of 2016. And all of the Russia meetings that are in the news right now happened back in June or thereabouts before Bannon joined the campaign. So far, he is not implicated. And that actually gives him latitude and leeway to be more of an influential advisor with Trump, because he doesn't need to check with his defense lawyers first in the way that some of Trump's other advisors now suddenly do.
Let me get Carol from Wilmington to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for taking
Whoops, did we lose you, Carol? Go ahead.
The question I had was how much of this Bannon connection is about the Browning of America? I feel like Bannon is probably more protective of the democracy for some, but not for others. Breitbart has a very strong white wing, white influence involved. And the other question I had is I question the hypocrisy of his Christianity stand, because one of their closest allies is Russia, who for a long time barred all religion. So what is that relationship about, the Russian relationship?
Sure,
so
and
I don't think he's for America as America is.
Well, those are both great questions.
Yeah, Carol, I appreciate the call, and it sounds like our guest wants to answer them. Go ahead, Joshua.
Yeah, those are both great questions. I think the Browning of America does concern Bannon, and I think the sign of this is you see him talk about, you know, we need to shut down immigration. We played the clip of Bannon in the interview saying, why do we need to let any immigrants in, any refugees in? He is consumed with the idea of preserving America's culture and national identity, which I think in Bannon's mind means an American identity as it has been historically in our country, which of course is whiter and more male as far as voting rights and political leaders 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, then it's going to be 20, 30, 40, 100 years from now. That is something that bothers him and a lot of the nationalists in his orbit. And I think that's one reason why they are so determined to shut down borders, keep out refugees, lower not only illegal immigration, but legal immigration too. On the other question of Bannon's religion, that is a tricky one. I mean, he professes to believe in this very traditional Catholicism, and yet I don't think tends to spend a lot of time at church.
I was wondering about
and,
that.
Yeah, and is actively critical of Pope Francis, and in fact helped set up a Breitbart News offshoot or bureau in Rome specifically to prop up splinter conservative members of the Catholic Church and attack Francis. And interestingly enough, last week the New York Times had a big story about two Francis loyalists who wrote a very important article that implicitly had Francis's endorsement, attacking Steve Bannon personally for his what they called his apocalyptic geopolitics and spurring a lot of this anti-immigrant sentiment. So Bannon, I think, is not only at war with immigrants and at war with the Republican establishment, I think he's also at war with the Pope and the Catholic Church. So that gives you a sense of the grandiosity of what he sees as his mission and his power from the West Wing of the White House.
But does it also say that he needs and wants an enemy, that motivates him?
I think that's right. And Bannon, it seems to me, is at his most effective. I do an afterword in the book to explain how is it that these guys who so shrewdly understood the weak points in the Republican and Democratic parties and got elected when nobody thought they could have turned out to be so terrible as president. They haven't really managed to accomplish anything. I think a big part of the reason for that is that during the campaign they had an enemy in Hillary Clinton, and that Trump and Bannon are both very good at tearing down their enemies. But now, once they're in power, they don't really have one. And you can see Bannon initially in the early months of the administration kind of groping and trying to create an enemy. First, it was the media, which he called the opposition party. And then when that didn't seem to work, he switched over to the deep state. You see Trump railing against everyone from the media to the New York Times, to Jim Comey, to Bob Mueller. I think what they're trying to do is find an enemy who can focus their attention and galvanize their supporters. The problem is that just having an enemy doesn't help you get legislation passed. And so it doesn't seem clear to me how Trump is going to be able to dig out of this hole and actually accomplish something, despite the fact that he and his party have unified control of Washington.
Let me play a scene from Saturday Night Live, Alec Baldwin as President Trump and a man dressed in death, playing death, plays Steve Bannon. This is from February of this year.
Send in Steve Bannon.
Hello, Donald. I have arrived.
Hi, Steve. You look rested.
Thank you.
Joshua, does he like being the butt of the joke?
I don't think he minded it initially. I mean, Bannon is a guy who came from obscurity. No one had heard of this guy a year and a half ago, and all of a sudden he's one of the most famous people in the world and being parodied on Saturday Night Live. I suspect he loved the attention. The problem for Bannon is that he got too much attention, and too much of it was along the lines of the Saturday Night Live portrayal that Bannon was really the president and that Trump, if you watch the rest of the skit, Grim Reaper Bannon makes Trump go sit at a little boy's desk and takes over the Oval Office himself. Trump has a very fragile ego, and this portrayal of Bannon as the true power and the puppet master absolutely enraged him. And Bannon nearly lost his job as a result of that back in late February and March. And to an extent, I think, is still, you know, fighting for his position in the inner circle, which is one reason why I think he's so unhappy about my book. But certainly getting that kind of attention does not help you when your boss is Donald Trump.
Well, we know that there are factions within the White House and the West Wing. As of today, Joshua Green, is Steve Bannon's star up or down?
Well, it's hard to say. He is back in a position of power that it looked like he'd lost in March. And part of that is by dint of the fact that the Russia investigation has so roiled this administration. Trump has actually leaned on Bannon to help him prop up this outside legal team. But I don't think he is the influential figure he once was. I mean, if you flash back 2 weeks, Bannon was adamantly against the hiring of Anthony Scaramucci as White House comms director. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and daughter Ivanka, were the ones really pushing that. And they just steamrolled Steve Bannon. So I don't think that he had the influence he once did. However, he is a survivor and he's a crafty guy. And flash forward 3 weeks and Steve Bannon is still in the White House and Anthony Scaramucci is not. So Bannon always seems to find a way to survive. But whether or not he can make it the full 4 years in Trump's White House, I'm not sure.
So it's not clear he will stick with the president through thick and thin?
Well, I think that Bannon will. It's not clear that he can survive the attacks coming his way. I mean, he has been at war with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, almost from the outset of the administration. Right now, he is in the midst of a pitched battle with H.R. McMaster, the president's national security director, and there are all sorts of fights and leaks going on there. So if Bannon can survive, he'll stick around. He doesn't want to leave the White House. But at some point, it may be too much to take, and Trump may throw him out. We'll see.
Joshua Green, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, Josh Green, our guest, and the book called Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. And he is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, joining us from the NPR Bureau in Washington, D.C. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.